I'll ask again. How's everybody doing? All right. So, you know, and Javian just got up here and he was talking about how he just had that mindset, like no little deed goes unnoticed before the Lord, and you don't know what happens when you do that little deed, which is what the video was about last week for those of you who weren't here. It was about a young man who was doing work for a charity, and he gave a lollipop to a girl for the charity because he's looking for donations, and she was afraid. She was at college, and she was standing online to go in, and she was afraid and thinking, okay, I can't do this. I'm going to back out. When he handed her that lollipop and cracked a joke, she just felt like, I can do this. He had no idea, and years later, he finds out that she decided to go to college and graduated because of that little lollipop. David was talking about Paul and Silas when they were in prison. And we talked about how it took an incredible amount of faith on Paul's part to go to Macedonia, right? Do you guys remember that we've been talking about this? A couple of us spoke about it, about having this faith to follow through, to do what God asks you to do, no matter how small, no matter what it looks like. And this morning, we're going to continue that conversation because I've been on this for, I would say, years now. But in particular, the last maybe 6 months, I can't get away from this whole thing of, God, how do we grow that? How do we grow what you've planted inside of us? How do we grow in faith? And then Marissa prophesied my message, your ways are always higher. Your ways are always higher. Your ways are always better than mine. I know I can trust you, when she was singing. So today we're going to talk about faith and donkeys. I know that sounds like a really weird combination, but just trust me. So when I was a kid, I was raised in a Christian home, but I remember very clearly being spoken to that there were two things you should never pray for. And I am dead serious about this. I was told never to pray for the gift of faith and never to pray for patience because you will suffer. How would you like growing? I never forgot it. It was so traumatizing to me. I never forgot those words. I was petrified as a kid growing up. Even when I got a little older, I was afraid to pray for faith because that meant that you were going to go through something really horrible and to the point where you might die or you would lose your faith and, you know, like completely. I was like, oh my God. But, you know, those verses in Hebrews chapter 11, right, the hall of faith, that chapter, those verses are really strong, but there's a key in there that we can learn from on how to grow this faith that we've been talking about for months now. So I'm going to read to you Hebrews 11, verse 1, and I know that you guys can say this by heart, but I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to explain something to you and then go into what the difference is. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. How many of you can recite that verse in your sleep, right? Well, the second part of that says it's the evidence of things not seen. If you don't understand what it's talking about, you kind of miss the whole teaching on faith here. The evidence, when it talks about evidence, it's a legal term, and it's talking about as if it's a business deal that hasn't happened yet. It's like as if you had the title deed for a property that you really didn't own yet. But in the spirit world, in heaven, you own it. So understand that what we're talking about here is that faith is not just something that's hoped for. That's the way we look at faith. Oh, I'm hoping for this. I'm believing for this. But that second part of the verse is what makes us understand really what it is. It literally, and you can look this up for yourself. I'm no genius here. You can look this up. It's forensic evidence in a matter of law that you can't see yet. It's talking about faith on a cellular level. It's like if you can own the cell, have the faith on a cellular level, know that It's something that's done in heaven that you haven't seen yet. It starts small, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. And then we get to that scary verse, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, five verses down. It is impossible to please him without faith. That's an ouch for me, because I grew up, like I said, being told, don't ever pray for faith, and don't ever pray for patience, because you're going to suffer if you do. Well, then how the heck do you please God? Well, let me back up a little bit. 5 years ago, we were here in church, and forgive me, but I can't remember if it was Sue prophesying or me, and not that it matters who it was, but one of us was prophesying that we saw these dog tags coming down, you know, like the kind of guys in the army wear, these dog tags coming down, and the Lord was bringing them down, and he said, grab hold of what you want. Grab hold of these gifts that you want, and I've always wanted faith. You know, the thing as a kid you were told not to pray for, that's what I wanted. It's almost like the natural kid thing. Don't touch this. That's what I want to touch. So I always, deep down inside, wanted faith. Always. And it never left me. It never left me. So what did I do? I said, God, I'm grabbing my dog tag of faith. That's what I said to myself. I grabbed that thing in spite of what I was raised in, you know, being fearful of it. And you know something? And I'm going to tell you this, so don't take it the wrong way, but a year later, I found out I had cancer in my eye. Now, I'm telling you not to take it the wrong way because God didn't cause the cancer. I want you to understand that. But I realize that if I want faith, when a test comes up, right, now it's time to walk this thing out. Now it's time to, like, we either believe this stuff or we don't. And I'm talking well beyond the dog tag here. I'm talking about all this stuff that we prophesy, all this stuff we talk about, all this stuff we talk about to the Lord and believe the Lord and declare, are we walking this out or not? So when push comes to shove, that's really when we go through the test. But you know what? At that point, I realized that the Lord was asking me to make a decision. God was asking me to make, I had to make a decision that I was going to trust in him no matter what the outcome was. Because I didn't know what the outcome was. And you know what? God showed up and he gave me the faith I needed. And my faith went to an entire new level at that point. Because I realized that the goal of faith isn't success. Hear me when I'm saying this. The goal is to grow. Right? Because we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We don't grow from the success. We grow from our failures. We grow from our weaknesses. You know when Paul said, when I am weak, then I am strong? That's where we grow. God had to grow my faith. And let me tell you something. I know for a fact he could have healed my eye instantaneously. I know that. But we have to have faith that God is in control. And this is what I'm going to talk about how to get to that place where we believe God is in control. And ironically enough, a year after I went through that whole bout 4 years ago with the cancer in my eye, I had found a recording of a prophetic word that we got once when we went out to the leaders' conference at Bethel. Now, this word was given to me the year before that I found out that I had the cancer, right? So, but I didn't find it. I totally forgot about it. But a year after, I found this recording. I was on the old Mac that we have, and I was like, it said prophetic word leaders conference. So I'm like, oh, I wonder what this is. And I clicked on it. Let me read it to you. This is a woman talking to me. She said, you're going down these rapids and there's all these sharp turns, these unexpected turns. And then she stops and she goes, there's a hairpin turn and how you approach it is going to make all the difference. You can look at it as either exhilarating or deadly. But I see you turning around and looking at him, looking back at him, and he's just comforting you and letting you know he's got you and that you're safe with him. That was given to me a year before I found out I had cancer. And then she started talking, or maybe it wasn't the same girl, it might have been somebody else, to both of us about she saw like a spring of hope coming up. And I want to tell you what I learned through that. I learned that you will never have faith in someone you don't trust. Faith can't grow without trust. Faith can only grow in the soil of trust. So if I don't learn to trust in God, I will never have faith in him. Now, let me tell you what the trust means. I looked it up in the dictionary online, Merriam-Webster. Trust is the firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something. So in order for us to even think about having faith for situations that arise, to have faith in God, we have to learn to trust him. Faith can only grow in the soil of trust. Now, the only reason, David touched on this briefly, and I'm not going to go into details, but the only reason I was willing to come to this church years ago was because when I was a kid, I had a vision of this church. Out of the clear blue, while I was walking my dog when I was a kid, I had a vision of the front right here, and there was right where that picture of the city is behind the projected thing, the projector screen, there was a picture of a scroll, and it said, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," and it was in English and Italian because it was an Italian-speaking church when it started. Clear vision, as clear as day. I can remember telling my mother about it, and that was it. That was the end of it. And then fast forward many years, when God called us to leave, to come to Jersey City, there was really like a revival going on in the little church we came from. So it kind of made it hard to leave. And then I had this incredible dream when we were coming here part-time. We were still in the other church, but we were coming here part-time. Then I had this incredible dream, and I was standing on a street, on a busy street that looked just like Newark Avenue. And then all of a sudden, I turned to my left, and there was the church. So it was like right in front of where the church is there. And I see this massive, massive baby in the parking lot. And I'm not going to go into the whole dream, but the Lord said in the dream, if you are willing to stand in the gap, your offspring will be as numerous as the stars in the sky, like a cattle on a thousand hills. Then I had a dream after that. I don't know how long, maybe a year after that, not even. Then I had a dream that David and I and John and Sue bought a two-family house in Jersey City. And it happened. Lost my family over that for a long period of time. It kind of seems like forever. But I did it because I learned to trust the dream giver. Now let's back up to which David talked about last week, to Paul's night vision of a man begging him to come to Macedonia, saying, please come and help us. Do you guys remember that, those of you who were here? If you weren't here, Paul just has a night vision. We'll call it a dream, whatever. Whatever it was, somebody came to him in the spirit and said, come help us. It was a man. And then Paul's plan was to go originally to Asia. Holy Spirit said no. Then he said, all right, I'm going to go to Bithynia. Holy Spirit says no, but says go to Macedonia. You know what? Paul trusted the dream giver. Why the vision of a man? I'm going to answer this once and for all so we can clarify it. I did speak about this. Apparently, I'm very boring and you guys fell asleep. This was months ago when I was preaching. But there was a reason, I believe anyway, even though it doesn't state it in Scripture, why it was a man. When Paul got to Macedonia, there was no synagogue, right? You can look this all up for yourself, but I'm just going to throw it out there for free. There was no synagogue. What that meant in the Jewish culture was that there wasn't even 10 men, had to be men, who were believers and followers of Yeshua. I'm not talking about Christians who followed Jesus, but they were following, it was Levitical law that there had to be at least 10 men, followers of Yeshua, to have a synagogue. So when Paul got there, there was no synagogue, and he knew that. So yes, that told Paul that, okay, there's not even 10 men here to start a synagogue. This is pathetic. That's why God sent a man to say, we need help in Macedonia. That's why there was no God believers there that were men, basically. If there were, there were under 10. Macedonia was a big city. Now, why did Paul go down to the river? Because when there was no synagogue, the people that were believers in Yeshua, they would go down to the river because they were still doing their ceremonial washings that were commanded in Levitical law. So if you're a believer in Yeshua and there's no synagogue, you would meet and have your little prayer meeting, if you want to call that, Bible study, Torah study, down by the water. So it was always by a river, so you can do your ceremonial washings. That's why when Paul realized there was no synagogue there, he went right down to the river. And that's where he meets Lydia, and it's the first church in Europe happens, and they get saved and all that good stuff. So Paul found out, okay, so this is where my ministry is right now. Why would God ask Paul specifically? Well, Paul was called to the Gentiles, right? And God had a specific assignment for him in Macedonia. Even though he thought his assignment was where? Bithynia or somewhere in Asia. God said, no, that's not where your assignment is. But you know what finally persuaded him to go? It was the vision. He had faith in the vision that God gave him, faith in the vision of the man. That's what, he didn't have faith for the entire nation of Macedonia to get saved. Are you hearing me? He had no clue. He didn't know what he was going to find when he got there. I'm pretty sure that he was planning on finding a synagogue. But that's not what he had the faith for. He only had faith in a dream that God gave him, in a vision that God gave him. But he knew God could be trusted. He knew it. God wasn't disappointed that Paul didn't have faith for the whole nation, but God was pleased that he said, all right, he may not have faith for the nation yet, but that's okay. He has faith in the vision, in the dream that I gave him. And that's all the faith we need. That is faith on a cellular level, on a forensic level. Paul had no idea what he was going to find. Let me tell you something. He wasn't laying up in bed at night praying for Macedonia, was he? The Bible doesn't tell us that's what was going on. In fact, if anything, he was probably praying for either Bithynia or Asia, which he said he wanted to go to, but Holy Spirit said no. So that gives us a pretty clear indication that he wasn't up night, staying up nights holding prayer meetings for Macedonia. He just had faith in the vision God gave him. That's all it was. He obeyed it because he trusted the dream giver. Faith takes time to build. It's not instant. Right? We start small and then God increases it. And let me tell you something. If God doesn't ask us to have faith for an entire nation, if we don't even have faith for our spouse or faith for our kids, it's a process that has to build. So if you're looking to have faith for an entire nation, but you don't even have faith for the things that are right in front of you, it ain't going to happen. Knowledge comes if we know of someone. Trust comes if we actually know someone. Trust is a process that leads us to faith. Are you hearing me? Without trust, there is no faith. Now, I want to read to you Luke chapter 19, verses 29 through 36. This is Jesus showing his disciples and all of Israel who he is and that he's trustworthy. Verse 29 says, as he approached Bethpage and Bethany at the hill called Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt there, which no one has ever ridden. It's a donkey. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Say, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you untying the colt? They replied, the Lord needs it. They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. And as he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. Now, this is prophesied in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, that Jesus would come in riding on a donkey. But why a donkey? How many of you know that when Jesus did something, or Jesus does something, it's always for a reason? Right? Nothing he did was by chance. Well, let's talk about a donkey for a minute. What were donkeys used for back then? To carry people. Donkeys were known to carry royalty. Kings would ride on donkeys, not on horses. King David rode a donkey all the time. And when King David was on his deathbed to make a statement, he had his son Solomon ride on that donkey. And you know why he did that? To tell all of Israel he is an heir to the throne. That's why he did that. There's a lot of other examples of that. I don't want to take the time to go into that. But clearly, when Jesus rode in on a donkey, he was making a declaration. I am the son of David, the one who was prophesied about. I am heir to the king's throne. He was making a statement. So they carried royalty. The other things donkeys did were carry gifts. And this is all over the Bible. I'm just going to give you a few examples. Do you remember when Jesse would send David to King Saul? And whenever Saul was experiencing this evil spirit would overtake him, every time he would send David, he would send him along with a donkey carrying gifts to King Saul. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 18, how many of you remember Abigail in the Bible? She's the wife of wealthy Nabal, who David was ready to kill. And she was like, uh-oh, time to send gifts. She sends all these gifts on a donkey. Now, isn't it interesting how Jesus is bought in by a gift carrier? Think about that for a minute. When Jesus ascended back to the Father and he sent Holy Spirit, who did he say the gifts were for? Who did he give the gifts to? Us, the church. He gave the gifts to us. Demonic phone. I thought this was really interesting because Jesus comes in on what's known as a gift carrier. And when Jesus gave us the Holy Spirit, he gave the gifts to us, the church, to you and I. So when we're carriers of the gifts, we are literally carrying Jesus into the atmosphere. And I think symbolically, Jesus is showing us here that he makes his entrance through us as the carrier of his gifts. And you know what? It's pointless to carry his gifts if we're not going to bring Jesus in riding on them. The palms were laid down before Jesus, for Jesus, about us, not for the donkey. They were for Jesus. Now, I want to talk to you about another few traits of the donkey, and then we'll start making the connections here. The donkey, remember it said a donkey that no one has ever ridden? Donkeys take like 1 year to train before they will let anyone ride on them. They aren't stubborn the way they have the reputation for. You ever heard stubborn as a mule? It's not that they're stubborn. They have trust issues like you and I, and they can sense your attitude. They will not let anyone get on them if they don't trust you. By Jesus saying, "Fetch me a donkey that no one's ever ridden on," he was saying, "You can trust me." And if you notice, when the disciples got the donkey and brought him back to Jesus, they didn't ride on that donkey. They were smart. I wouldn't have done it either. But he said, "Get me one that no one's ever ridden on," specifically. Donkeys always find the easiest path to travel in rough terrain. This article I read, it was funny. They actually said they're like a GPS with fur. I'm serious. That's what the article said. They would send out donkeys first in Israel when they were building roadways because they always found the easiest paths. They're like pioneers. They cut through anything. And that's how they would build their roads in Israel. I was blown away by this. They can survive in almost any terrain. Now, we know this from Job because when God was reminding Job, like, excuse me, you're not in control of everything. I am. In Job chapter 39, verses 5 to 8, it says, "Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied its ropes? I gave it the wasteland as its home, the salt flats as its habitat. It laughs at the commotion in the town. It does not hear a driver's shout." Could you imagine that in Jersey City? "It ranges the hills for its pasture and searches for any green thing." Donkeys are survivors. They also carry real heavy loads. You know they're even stronger than horses, pound per pound? I didn't even know that. They can travel for extremely long durations. They remember everything from the time they're born. They have incredible memories. And they last for about 25 years. They said literally their memory will last for 25 years. And they don't do well alone. They need relationship, which I thought was really... We have a totally different concept of... I shouldn't say we. I had a totally different concept of a donkey than what they're really known for. What's the point? When Jesus made his final entry into Jerusalem, he didn't request a donkey just so he can fulfill the prophecy in Zechariah. It was a sign to us. When he said, "Hey, I need a donkey. Go get me a donkey. I need someone who can trust me, someone who is a carrier of my gifts, someone who can navigate through the tough spots and still find a way, Somebody who is willing to carry a heavy load, to take up their cross. Someone who can usher in my presence when I'm ready to come into the city. Now, I'm not saying you're a donkey, but listen, I'm reading this and I'm like, Jesus, this sounds like what we're supposed to be, right? And there's something else that's really interesting here. So this is what happens, right? He goes into the city. You know the story. They cast down the palms before him. Now, how prophetic is this? A donkey, by the way, in Bible times was a sign of peace. They would lay down these palm branches. Somebody yell out here, what do palm branches represent? Peace. I'm coming in peace. Lay it down before me. I'm coming in peace. Lay it down before me. I'm coming in peace. When Jesus was coming in, knowing he was going to die on the cross, he was trying to make a statement, I come in peace. You can trust me. I'm coming in peace. I'm going to lay down my life for you. I'm coming in peace. Now, clearly, when Jesus returns, and he's coming on that white horse, that was a war animal. That's totally different. But his first time on earth, before he ascended into heaven, he tried over and over and over again to make it clear to you and I, to the people of the day, because we get to read the story afterwards, I'm coming in peace. You can trust me. You can trust me. Sometimes we miss this stuff. So anyway, so the day after he makes this bold statement by what he did, that you can trust me, he's hungry, and he passes this very leafy fig tree that has no figs on it, and he curses it and says, may you never bear fruit again. It's really weird. Sounds almost harsh, but I'm going to read it to you. It's Mark 11, verses 12 through 14, and then we're going to jump to verse 19 for the sake of time. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went out to find it, if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, may no one ever eat of your fruit again. And his disciples heard him say it. Isn't that strange? He expects fruit out of season. When evening came, Jesus and the disciples went out of the city. Verse 20, in the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. Have faith in God, Jesus answered. Truly I tell you, if anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in their heart, but believes that what they say will happen, it will be done for them. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. What I think is funny is the disciples really don't have a clue why Jesus really cursed the fig tree or what it meant. They were just wowed, like, oh my God, I can't believe this. This thing, like, died. Well, I have never heard of this, but did you guys ever hear of a breba crop? I did not know this, so I started doing research. I'm like, why would he curse it? I never really looked into that. I mean, poor fig tree, if it's out of season, why would it be bearing fruit, right? Well, many fig trees, especially in Israel, bear more than one crop, and I didn't know that. There's something today that, like I said, it's called a breba crop. It's called an out-of-season crop, and it's produced on mature branches of fig trees on the previous year's wood. Because what happens is when the fig tree grows, the figs come on the new branches that grow over the next year. But the breba crop, it comes on the old, mature wooden branches. And these are the largest sweet figs that come on the tree. And it doesn't come without leaves. So even though it's small in number, like these figs, everybody goes nuts for. And especially after such a long season in the winter where the figs weren't being produced. So everybody would go nuts for this breba crop. So this leafy tree in the distance was holding out the promise of some really good fruit, right? It was blessing, sustenance, life, right? It showed that it had life. So now it's Passover time, right around the time when this breba crop produces. And Jesus rightfully expected there to be fruit, good fruit on it, on a mature branch. So what's interesting is he realizes it's not producing what it's supposed to produce. And what the disciples didn't get, that now I understand after researching this, is that it was symbolic of what was going on in the church of that day. The Jewish leaders, meaning the priests, the rabbis, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. They were all Israel's matured branches, right? But it was all just for show. It was a bunch of leaves without fruit, right? Complete hypocrisy. It was a dire warning of the judgment that was coming on Jerusalem, which did in 70 AD. So Jesus sees this, and it's a prophetic picture, and he obviously knows that, of the mature branch in Israel, the mature church, supposedly. And don't think for one minute that we're immune to this. God help us if we ever come to this, that we are a church that's producing nothing but leaves and there's no fruit. Jesus had no problem cursing it at the root. Now, let's go to Mark chapter 11, verse 22 to 24. Have faith in God, Jesus answered. Truly, I tell you, if anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in their heart, but believes that what they say will happen will be done for them. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. In other words, you think this dying fig tree is so cool. That's nothing. Notice he's talking about faith, that if you believe what you say will happen, it will happen. He's talking about the power of declaration here, right after he curses the fig tree. He's trying to explain to the disciples about the power of declaration. He was teaching them to trust their words because their words, if they are connected with the Creator, are God's words. Now, I want to take it up a notch to you, because this almost seems like, why is he telling them this right after the fig tree? It's almost like he says the curse, and they're wowed that it withered, and he's saying, you know, don't be wowed by this, because if you say to this mountain, go cast yourself into the sea, it'll cast itself into the sea. Like, understand the power that's in your words. Now, I want to take you to Matthew chapter 17, verses 19 and 20. This is talking about, I don't know if you guys remember the story, a boy who had a demon. And the disciples couldn't cast this thing out for nothing. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and said, why couldn't we drive it out? Because Jesus did. They couldn't. Jesus comes along and he casts out the demon. And he replied to them in verse 20 of Matthew chapter 17, because you have so little faith. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. Now, John actually talked about this the last time we were here, about mustard seed, the smallest of all seeds. This was on Wednesday night, I believe. The smallest of all seeds. Yet, I don't know if you guys know this, it produces the largest amount of herbs. It's huge. It grows to 20 feet high, sometimes 30, and it spreads out so much. Sometimes it goes to 20 feet wide. It gets huge. Jesus was saying that if you have the faith to believe that this little mustard seed will produce all of this, that's all the faith that I'm requiring for you to move a mountain. It isn't so much in the size of the seed. It's believing how much it can reproduce. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not the size of it. It's believing that if you command it to reproduce, it'll reproduce. You trust that when you put that seed into a ground, if you're a farmer, that what's going to happen? It's going to produce a crop. If I plant a tomato plant, I put the seed in there, I'm trusting that it's going to produce a crop, right? Jesus was saying it's no different than the seed coming out of your mouth. That seed can cause a mountain to move. It's faith in the little things that make the big things happen. It's faith on a cellular level. Now, let me explain something to you. This happened before Jesus cursing the fig tree and saying, if you cast that mountain, if you tell that mountain to go cast itself into the sea, it'll do it. So when Jesus casts the demon out of this demoniac child, and he's restored, and he starts talking to them about faith. This was on Mount Hebron, totally different mountain. And he says, if you speak in faith, this mountain will move from here to there. It's Mount Hebron. in Mark chapter 11, verse 22, Jesus is at the base. This is later on, right after he rides through on the donkey. Jesus is at the base of the Mount of Olives, pointing to that mountain and says, if you have faith to cast it into the sea, it will happen. What's the difference? Well, in the first example that I gave you in Mount Hebron, which happened first, it's not from here to there anymore. He said, if you have faith like a grain of mustard seed, right? If you believe the mustard seed will become this humongous tree, that's all you need to move a mountain, right? It's not from moving it from here to there. Now he's saying you can cast it into the sea. So he's already upping the ante a little bit. Now think about this for a minute. Jesus had not ascended yet, right? Obviously. Well, guess where he's going to ascend? Anybody know? Mount of Olives. The prophet Zechariah prophesied this. Zechariah 14:4 specifically, if you want it. It was prophesied in Zechariah that Jesus would return to the Mount of Olives. When he comes back, the Messiah was going to come back to the Mount of Olives. Now, how many of you know the disciples read the Torah? Do you believe that? They knew the scriptures, their scrolls, that they were called scrolls at the time. They were familiar with the scripture in Zechariah. They knew that Messiah, which they believed Jesus was, they had already declared that in faith. Remember, Peter, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. They believed that Messiah was coming back to the Mount of Olives to when he returned. So what's interesting is the ascension Jesus knew was going to happen on the Mount of Olives. The disciples didn't know that yet. But they knew the return of the Messiah was coming back to the Mount of Olives because it was prophesied in Zechariah. So now, what's harder to believe when he told them about Mount Horeb saying, move from here to there, or the Mount of Olives where Jesus was going to return and saying, cast that mountain into the sea. If you declare it, you can do it. What do you think would be harder for them to believe? Anybody? You guys falling asleep? Are you getting this? I'm sorry. Cast the mountain into the sea, A, because now the mountain's got to jump into the sea, but B, and most importantly, they already knew that that's where Messiah was going to return to, so why the heck would he tell us about casting this into the sea? You understand? Jesus wasn't asking them to have faith in the mountain. He was stretching their faith from the previous time he told them to move a mountain by talking to it. He was stretching their faith. He wasn't asking them to have faith in the mountain. He was asking them to have faith in the words that they declared, to trust in the words that you declare. He didn't say, ask me to move the mountain. Pray to me night and day that I'll move that mountain and I'll move it. He said, you say to this mountain, move from here to there. That's a big difference. He was trying to build their faith. Jesus spoke about mountains a lot, and 9 times out of 10, when he spoke about mountains, it was about building your faith. And the only way you build your faith is when you trust somebody. He didn't need to build his faith. He was trying to build their faith. They needed it, just like we do. When the disciples were shocked at the fig tree dying, Jesus was telling them, even though you know that it says in the Holy Scriptures that I'm returning on this mountain, on the Mount of Olives, your words are so powerful that if you say to this mountain with faith, go throw yourself into the sea, it will cause the mountain to jump into the sea. This is a total stretch from the last time in Mount Horeb saying, if you have faith, tell that mountain to move from here to there. That's how we learn to trust God in the everyday little things of our life, and our faith will grow exponentially. The disciples are like, what? Why would you tell us to do that if we know Messiah is coming back here? You're coming back to this mountain. That's what faith can do. That's what he's trying to tell them. You're trusting in the Lord, trusting in the everyday little things on a cellular level can grow and grow and grow to the place where you actually believe what you speak. It's the power of declaration. Don't wait until you feel like you have enough faith to make a mountain move. only wait until you trust the one that told you to move it. You understand what I'm saying? What? Say it again. Don't wait until you feel like you have enough faith to make a mountain move. Only wait until you trust the one who told you to do it. What's the dream in your heart? Think about it. Think about what God's told you. Think about maybe literal dreams. In my case, I dream a lot, like literal dreams. Think about something that God said to you that sounded too big. You know, sometimes I think we had to be nuts to believe that we could actually make a dent in changing this city. But maybe when we moved here, God really wasn't asking me to have the faith that the whole city would get changed. He was asking me to have faith in the dream that he gave me, just like Paul. I saw such a parallel this week that I never saw before. He didn't have faith for Macedonia, and God wasn't expecting him to have faith for the entire nation. He was just expecting him to trust in the dream that God gave him. He trusted the dream giver, and that's all God's asking us to do. Like I said, when you read Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, the evidence of things not seen, the forensic evidence that says it's there, even though you can't see it with your eye. It's on a cellular level. Something small that you think may mean nothing. My dream maybe means nothing to anybody else. But you know what? It's what caused us to move here. It's what caused me to start coming to this church when I had the dream as a kid. It's what caused us to buy a duplex together. For me, that was the confirmation that God gave me. And don't think it was easy to do, man. We went through, I don't even want to say what we went through to get that house. It was insanity. I can't tell you how many times you're like, oh my God, is this you, God? Is this you, God? Is this you, God? And you know what? There's a lot of stuff that's been going on this year. A lot of blessing, loss. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's been going on for the past year. And all I keep finding myself saying is, God, I trust your plan. I don't understand it, but I trust your plan. That's all I keep saying because it doesn't make sense to me. I really think I have a better idea than what God does. But God, if you did it this way, this would happen. I can't tell you, and I'm just being real with you. I can't tell you how many times this year I have cried in my bedroom. I mean, bawling my eyes out. It's like, God, it hurts. It started when my dad passed away suddenly, and it's happened multiple times. Because I know God's okay with me telling him how I really feel, as if he doesn't know anyway. But sometimes it just makes you feel better when you tell him how you feel. Like, it hurts. But I trust your plan anyway. I keep saying that, God, but I trust your plan anyway. Because I trust who he is. I don't know what the future is going to bring. See, if Paul trusted God, but still did his own plan, he would have been in Asia or Bithynia, and then that whole miracle wouldn't have happened where he goes down, Lydia gets saved, he casts out the demon of the young girl, which David talked about last week. He winds up getting thrown in prison. The jailer gets saved. His family gets saved. God only knows how many thousands more people got saved from that one jailer. God only knows the suffering he went through when he accepted Christ. A brutal Roman jailer. I can't even imagine what he went through with his family. So sometimes we're wrong in what we think God should do. We gotta own up to that. It's okay. God's okay with that. Maybe we trust in our own plan too much. It's not his plan. Okay, God, but I trust what you said, so I'm going to do it anyway. I trust what you say. What's the mountain God's asking you to speak to? So I'm going to ask you this morning to start exercising this process of trusting the dreamer before you try and have faith for the outcome. Because like I said, outcomes don't always happen the way we want them to be. They don't only happen the way we want them to happen. Paul trusted God's plan, and the rest is history. Literally, like it's written in the book for us to follow. To follow his mistakes too, by the way, not only his successes. So let's be like the donkey. Let's not be afraid to be a donkey and trust the dream giver. Let's trust what he said. All right, let's get up and make just a couple of declarations. I'm trying to just explain this so you guys can get this on a level where it's real to you, because sometimes it's overwhelming when you see what's going on in the world around us, and we're praying for this country and that country and our country and like these big ticket things, and we really don't have the faith for these big ticket items. That's okay. Have faith in the little things. Trust the one who can give you a specific place to pray for. You guys ready? I fully believe that Jesus is trustworthy. His trustworthiness is not based on what I think the outcome should be. Is not based on what I think the outcome should be. I build my faith by exercising it in the little things. I trust the dream giver.
Amen.